Hey, this is Tierney Finster, host of Tierney Talks, an interview show where I talk to my favorite experts about their lives and passions. My guests include artists, writers, actors, estheticians, hypnotists, curators, money coaches, beauty entrepreneurs, political candidates, and more. The talk is always smart, always hot, and always fun. Enjoy. Hey, welcome to Tierney Talks. I'm back. I'm here with someone whose work I deeply, deeply, deeply admire, Jane Ward.
Hi.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for being here amid everything going on.
Oh, it's really good to connect whenever possible, however possible.
So true. That goes for everyone who will eventually be listening to this too. Thank you for being here with us. I'm really happy because we're celebrating your new book today, Jane, The Tragedy of Heterosexuality. So congratulations.
Thank you.
It's been out just a few weeks, I believe, September earlier this month.
Mm-hmm.
And I just finished it last week. I absolutely loved it. I found it so entertaining, which you don't always say about scholarly works to this caliber. So I just really appreciated everything you shared.
Thank you. That means a lot to me. I really do try, now that I have tenure and I have the luxury of being able to find my own voice in my writing and speak to audiences that matter to me, I do really try to write accessibly and in a way that engages the reader so that they want to read the whole book and not the way many academics engage with scholarly books, which is, you know, to just kind of dip into one chapter and make use of portions of the book for our teaching. So one of the great things is that I'm in a writing group. It's actually a lesbian writing group called Leserati in LA, and I've been in that group for many years. And there are playwrights and poets and memoirists, and so they have really pushed me to think about writing more as a craft, and that's been really great.
I love that, so that you have this space. You've given yourself more and more space to explore the craft to your liking and for your own community, and that's taking effect in what you create.
Exactly.
Yeah, it felt like my friend, my extremely smart friend, was just telling me how it is. And what you're talking about with that kind of experience of reading some more academic writing where I kind of Bible dip in, see where I land, read, come back another time. And that can go on for like a really long time because only a few pages are very digestible or something. And I don't know, I felt like I don't want to deduce the literary quality of the work because I'm just such a TV-minded person, but I felt like every chapter was an episode of an amazing, juicy, sexy docuseries.
Ooh, okay. I feel like that docuseries needs to be made.
Yes. If I had the production budgets I deserve, it would be already on its way with you at the helm. I think for a lot of people, the idea that heterosexuality is a tragedy somewhat intuitively resonates, if not really explicitly resonates. But you've done such an interesting job framing the story as, you know, the story of the history of heterosexuality as a tragedy in and of itself in many ways. How did you go about naming the book, or how did you feel upon coming to the idea of naming it The Tragedy of Heterosexuality?
Mm-hmm. Well, I considered another title, which is The Failure of Heterosexuality, and that title, I think, also would have worked, and it would have maybe pointed more directly to the dysfunction of heterosexuality. I mean, one of the central arguments of the book is that, you know, we're all familiar with the story about how queerness, ostensibly, you know, according to kind of mainstream heteronormative culture, that queerness leads to loneliness and depression and suicidality, and there's so much discrimination, and that this just all results in such a hard life. And even though there's so much evidence to the contrary, that narrative about how tragic it is to be queer really persists. I mean, you especially, it comes up, I think, for a lot of us when we're coming out to our parents. And, you know, maybe our parents are like, well, I'm totally fine with other people being gay, but now I'm worried about you, you know, because I don't want your life to be hard. And just all of this sense of loss and mourning that something, yeah, that something is lost when you are queer. And in this book, I basically start from the premise that, you know, that story about the tragedy of queerness is not at all my own experience, and it's not the experience of most queer people that I know, for whom, yes, homophobia and heteronormativity suck, but the queer parts of our life are so delicious, so joyous, so liberating. And so the narrative just didn't really make a lot of sense to me. And then combine that with how unhealthy straight culture looks from the outside. And I just felt like there's really a contradiction here, where there's a way that we aren't allowed to speak the truth about what straightness really means for people, especially for women. And I think this came into focus for me because I'm in my 40s now and I have a kid. So I know a lot of straight women because they're parents, you know, so I meet them through my kids' school and all of that, and my colleagues. And one of the things that you know went pretty quickly when you hang out with a lot of straight women is that they really spend a lot of time complaining about how shitty men are. You know, mm-hmm. They really like to share with you that how all the ways that men are trash. And so I have really got an earful over the years from straight women about how they wish they could be lesbians, but they can't. But if they could, they would, because men, you know, don't do their fair share of the emotional labor, the parenting labor, the household labor, you know, all of this. And that combined with all of the research that I've been tracking as a gender studies scholar on the realities of violence against women, physical violence, sexual violence, emotional violence committed by men, the persistence of misogyny, the daily inequities that women experience in their relationships with men, the entrapment that women, especially women of color, experience, and poor and working class women, to stay with men who mistreat them because of either not having economic security without male partners or fear of loss of their children if they try to leave the relationship. And so the more I have followed the research on these enduring ways that straight women suffer, the clearer it has become to me that heterosexuality is actually the tragedy, especially for women.
Yes. And I really like how, in doing what you just explained, you offer a chance to reframe or at least expand that idea of who's an ally to who in queer straight friendships, because we know that straight people get to be proud allies when they are, or to feel some type of way about that. But as you explain so often, queer people, especially queer women, are listening to straight women complain or critique their own, you know, romance and life. And so often the queer people are the ones being allies to straight women in the face of the misogyny and patriarchy in their own relationships.
Totally. And it's not even just about how much emotional support we often provide to straight women in particular, but also, and this isn't even something I explore at any length in the book, but we know from feminist historians that the founders of rape crisis centers, the founders of shelters for women, the shelter movement, the, you know, some of the most prominent feminist foremothers, you know, all of these folks, there's an overrepresentation of lesbians on the front lines of this kind of work. And so it's not just that now we find ourselves getting an earful from straight people about how shitty their relationships are, but also that lesbians have done a lot of the labor of building an infrastructure designed to make straight women's lives and relationships more equitable. And one interesting example of this, actually, this comes from Tristan Taramino, who is a feminist pornographer, came once and gave a lecture in my lesbian studies class that was just so fascinating, because what she showed was that the sex positivity movement and the transition from like kind of dark male dominated seedy sex shops that, you know, in the 70s and 80s, women mostly would probably be fearful to enter, sort of transitioning from that to these like brightly lit pink, totally sex positive, totally queer positive spaces like Toys and Babeland and Good Vibrations and all of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. That lesbians were really at the helm of that transformation. And so now, you know, she talked quite a bit about how straight people now can go into Good Vibrations, and usually it's a dyke or some queer person who's going to like explain to them, okay, yes, you can peg your boyfriend. Here's bend over boyfriend. Like, here's how you do it. So there's also just also a lot of sexual knowledge that mm-hmm. queer people have passed on to straight people. So part of what I'm trying to highlight in this book is that straight people are really living with the legacy of a very difficult and unfinished transition from heterosexual marriage as a deeply patriarchal and pragmatic institution that had nothing to do with love or companionship, to a pretty recent, like, modern notion of marriage as companionate marriage, in which men and women are actually supposed to like each other. And that this actually was a really hard thing to accomplish, because patriarchy and misogyny were so normalized for so many centuries, and women were basically men's property. And so what we're seeing now, I think, is still the kind of ripple out effects of that very difficult transition, that it's really hard to create a sexual orientation around, that presumes that men love women under conditions of misogyny, in which boys and men are taught to hate women. And so built into heterosexuality, or like baked into heterosexual, the culture of straightness, is that contradiction. And there's been a lot of work done to chip away at it, but it's not completely, you know, resolved.
Totally. We So we have so much to thank. All feminists have so much to thank to the lesbian feminist predecessors, especially lesbians of color, who pushed forward the feminist movement and created so much knowledge and curiosity around feminist issues that we're still building on today. And yeah, I was surprised by how recent, I don't know, you know, time-wise, it's like very, this book is such a map. It's mapping so many things that are so personal to a lot of us, but also to just this like culture and society at large. But, you know, in the book, you mentioned Trump as an example of like, if you think we're over misogyny in this country, if you think we girl bossed our way out of it, or if representation politics were enough, you know, the election of Donald Trump as president really shows that the spirit of misogyny is alive and well in America. But I think a lot of people, especially, you know, you and I met as I was writing about sexual and gender culture a lot for magazines, and men's magazines specifically, and the kind of men's rights movement and different masculinity cultures that are associated with the rise of Trump and the hatred of women online. I often was in newsrooms that were reporting on that stuff as though they were breaking, and I kind of internalized that perspective too. And of course, the current events of it were, but as you, I think, once told me, like, men have been organizing themselves as victims for 150 years. So it's just interesting time-wise that so much of male behavior or misogyny that is kind of continually rebrands itself to feel new is actually really, really not only old, but essential to the American iterations of these romances.
Absolutely. And, you know, the invention of heterosexuality as an identity, which, you know, only happened in the late 1800s, both heterosexuality and homosexuality get coined in the late 1800s. And, you know, that time marks the transition from thinking about opposite sex and same-sex sex practices as behaviors to thinking about them as like identities that then later become linked to biology, you know, with the belief that we're born with these sexual constitutions intact. And with the emergence of those categories, we absolutely see, you know, this proliferation of work to define, you know, well, what does it mean to be born a heterosexual? This is a new idea. So we're going to start, you know, trying to establish this category. And there's all of the sexological research that's being done and, you know, writing around this question. And, you know, one of the characteristics that emerges is that men are supposed to feel a kind of romantic attraction toward women, that they're supposed to feel a longing for women, a desire to partner with women. And even though now we completely take that for granted, there's some really incredible research that shows that men really resisted that idea, because the idea that you could love a woman, that you could actually love a woman who was such a degraded figure, you know, who was basically a slave to you, really raised some eyebrows for men who were like, that's impossible. If for me to love such a degraded figure will degrade me, and it will threaten my control of women, of the women in my life, and of women collectively, if men love women, that's could potentially threaten patriarchy, because men might, through that love, start to respect women, start to grant certain kinds of power to women. So I was really inspired by one of those histories in particular. It's Afsana Nashmabadi's book, Women with Mustaches, Men Without Beards. And it's about that moment and that crisis in Iran in the 19th century, and how the idea that modern heterosexuality, which was the new concept, was attached to companionship or some kind of mutual regard between men and women was very, very threatening to men, and how basically, you know, the Iranian state had to kind of launch a campaign to get men to get on board with that idea of loving women. And, you know, you see similarly around the globe. I mean, I have a whole chapter that's about that in the US context. How did sexologists and physicians, and many of them were eugenicists in the early 20th century, try to convince men to stop raping women, brutalizing women, beating women, and actually forge some kind of affectionate relationship? It was a really new idea.
Can you explain a little bit about why eugenicists and why upholding white supremacy became a part of sort of this heterosexual project of defining heterosexuality and creating cultural propaganda around how it should or could exist?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it was mostly about making white babies. So the eugenics movement, for folks who don't know, was a movement that was very popular in Europe and the US in the early 20th century, and from 1900 about 1930. And it was based on this idea, you know, it was basically social Darwinism, that you could encourage people of good genetic stock to reproduce and discourage people who you thought were of poor genetic stock from reproducing. In some cases, you might sterilize them, as we have a history of white supremacist sterilization of women of color in the U.S. And so the one of the pieces of this history that I focus on in the book is that, you know, I went to go look for the earliest hetero self-help books for straight couples, because we know that's a huge industry now, and I wanted to trace it back to its origins. And what I found was that the earliest of these marriage advice manuals were all written by eugenicists, and they were especially concerned that maybe white marriages were facing a crisis of sorts, because what they found, many of them were also physicians with family practices, what they found is that the men and women who would come to them as their family doctor described such a horrific state of affairs in their marriages that there was profound resentment and mutual loathing, so that basically people would stop wanting to have sex with each other. Women often, you know, men often raped their wives on the wedding night, not at all concerned with what women's sexual, you know, what women's experiences of sex were. Women often found their husbands' bodies repulsive. Men too often reported finding certain things about their wives' bodies repulsive. I mean, this was also a time when, you know, people commonly had syphilis, when, there were really different norms for hygiene, when people
maybe had very little information about sex and also very little opposite sex contact before they married. So you just have to imagine people getting together and suddenly this expectation of mutual sexual desire, and it just was not working. And so I was just so surprised to discover all of these eugenicists describing basically repulsion, you know, that there was so much physical repulsion on the part of husbands and wives. So they set out to try to intervene in this, to like teach people about the realities of the body, to teach men to stop raping women, to teach men to understand teach women to understand their husbands' kind of innate sexual aggression, was how they framed it. All hoping that this would preserve white marriages and therefore white families, and then, you know, consequently white society.
It's wild. I mean, I thought that the idea of, it's like you talk a lot about, it's very normalized that, yeah, men hate women and women hate men. But I didn't expect it to be such a historical concept. But when you frame it like that, it makes sense that it could have been even more intense, because we basically weren't even around each other as, like, quote, different sexes. So being, like, kind of forced into this really intimate confinement must have been very challenging. And yeah, just continuing to map what your book is really about, it's speaking to this precise challenge still today, that even though we've had about 100+ years of heteroromantic self-help literature, that there's still not really taking. And of course, one of the reasons is because most of it's really pent up or linked to gender differences that are assumed to be essential, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you know, what starts to happen is that focus on men and women's bodies and hygiene and building mutual attraction really shifts with the rise of the discipline of psychology in, you know, by the 1940s and 50s, so that these marriage advice manuals focus less on men and women's different bodies and start to focus on their presumably very different and conflicting personalities. And so that kind of jump starts what becomes the trend for many decades and that continues to this day, which is sort of the men are from Mars, women are from Venus kind of framing, that, you know, women and men want, I mean, here's the story. Women and men want really different things out of relationships. They have different interests, different ways of communicating, different things that they want out of life, different things that nurture them, different ways of being recognized, different emotional needs. And so they don't actually get along very well because of this. And this is why heterosexual relationships are so difficult and why so many end in divorce. So the story goes that if men and women can just learn more about each other, about how these differences are natural, and then kind of learn to work around them with a set of tricks or strategies, which really often just look like manipulations, then, you know, maybe they'll be able to make it work. So, you know, it's really been 50 years, you know, starting with the self-help books of the 1980s, like, you know, men who ate women and the women who loved them, and this kind of thing, then up to Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus. And then now, like, he's just not that into you, and act like a lady, think like a man. This is just in the last, you know, 20 years. All of these books advise women, you know, they basically say, like, look, men are like little boys. They need a tremendous amount of praise, and they need you, even if you don't feel like praising them for doing something basic like washing a dish or taking out their own trash, you've got to do it because that's what enables them to stay in a relationship with you when otherwise they might have the desire to leave. And so, so women are just trained over and over, or advised over and over again, to express to men the kind of positive reinforcement that you would give maybe like a toddler, a 2-year-old,
right,
behavior. And so it's amazing to me how often that story about the gender binary, the fixity of the gender binary, and this terrible advice about how you should fake it and manipulate your way through, continues to be repeated over and over and over again, even though clearly it actually doesn't work at all.
Right. I mean, it's confusing because some of the most popular narratives about heterosexuality in mainstream media, they conflict because it's everything you're describing about these essential differences, and heterosexuality is basically understood as inherently rife with conflict. But on the kind of other side of things, there's also such dominant and, you know, penetrating narratives about, you know, the prince who's going to save us, and how heteroromantic love provides such fulfillment and protection, and how, you know, it's going to make your life easier in some ways even. So yeah, I guess it's just a little bit discouraging to have to go into a heteroromantic relationship knowing that, like, the expectation across, it's no surprise that there's a low bar in a lot of hetero romances when the initial expectation is that, like, there's so much difference between us that it's going to be really hard.
Right. Right. And that very contradiction that you just pointed to, I think, explains why there's so much propaganda, you know, so much campaigning to sell heterosexuality to children, particularly to girls, in childhood, because otherwise it wouldn't make sense, right? You know, that we're telling you that this thing that is inherently fraught, you know, that's going to involve so much compromise and dissatisfaction and alienation, is also the thing that's going to make you wildly happy and successful. So in order to reconcile that in some way, or to continue to sell this shitty product that is heterosexuality, we start really early with Disney movies and all of that, you know, like getting girls hooked on the idea of a Prince Charming.
Yeah, needing that. And, you know, you talk about being able to, you know, of the long term of this, which we'll get into more a little later, but like hopefully imagining a heterosexual culture that doesn't like insist upon coercion.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, that's how, you know, people really hate Andrea Dworkin, and, you know, she, people often a tribute to her, something that she didn't actually put this way, but about how, you know, any sex involving a penis is rape. Yeah. I think it's what people say. But really, you know, what she was arguing was that until until we've changed the conditions of patriarchy such that women aren't in a structural bind that compels them to be in relationships with men, then we can't know if women are freely choosing those relationships with men. And hence we can't really know if heterosexuality is what we think it is. So, absolutely. The last chapter of this book is trying to gesture towards another possibility, and the place that I turned for that other possibility was lesbian feminism, and especially some of the brilliant writing that was done in the 1970s and 80s by lesbian feminists who were thinking about straight women and what it means to be an ally to straight women, and how you can't be a lesbian feminist who is committed to feminist justice without figuring out, you know, how are we going to free all women, that includes straight women. And so lesbian feminists spent a lot of time trying to think this through. And then I think what happened is that the AIDS epidemic was so devastating and really required all queer hands on deck that much of that writing and the activism of many lesbian feminists got kind of redirected away from thinking about the dysfunction of heterosexuality to caretaking for gay men who are dying. And I think we also see that queer theory, you know, emerging in the early 90s and queer politics, that is interconnected with that, also really centered gay men. And so this meant that this question about, like, is it possible to have a just or free or self-determined sexual relationship with a man if you are a woman, it got kind of dropped. And so part of what I wanted to do with this book was bring that project back into the foreground and pick up some of those voices again.
Well, I'm so glad you did. I mean, I felt very personally impacted by so much in the book. But yeah, it's just very interesting to think about the question you raised with Andrea Dworkin, because that's, you know, obviously your book isn't, I didn't really give a lot of time to saying, this doesn't mean straight people are bad, you know, or like not all straight couples are bad, or some straight people are happy. But I think a lot of people who listen will understand that we're not talking about any one individual straight person, straight man, or straight couple. We're talking about the culture of heterosexuality, just like there are white allies. But that doesn't take away from white supremacy being the dominant force in this country, you know? I feel like this book is very interesting and juicy for all sexual orientations. Just want to say that. can I give you some ASMR with my paper while I look at a note?
Absolutely. Thank you. I love ASMR. It doesn't really work for me. I don't get any of the tingles, but I'm interested in it as a cultural thing.
Me too. I just love it as a way that people get pleasure. Well, one thing I wanted to emphasize from what you were just explaining is that we take for granted as queer people, or, you know, like the idea that the freedom to be someone's lover and their friend and their colleague and their comrade, or whatever descriptors you want to use to say that in queer relationships, we often have more of a sense of getting to be all parts of ourselves. And the expectation often is that there's room for all those parts. And I think something that I think is sad is just, you know, a lot of times, and I know this from my own behavior too, that in heterodynamics, that a lot of times women swallow themselves, even like extremely feminist women, because the expectation is just simply that men really don't give a fuck about, you know, something you felt or one part of who you are or your experience of feminism or misogyny or, you know, the kind of things we're talking about right now. That might be something you save for your queer friends or your feminist friends and not for your partner. So when we look to lesbian feminists to inspire this next generation of heterosexual couples and to transform this culture of heterosexuality, we hopefully move forward to that place where we get, you know, women get to be all of ourselves in all relationships. And then I also really like how, I don't want to say I like it, but I appreciated the way you called attention to, you know, gay men, particularly gay white men, often having like history or queer theory centered around their experience, and how doing so might account for why, you know, they're wasn't as much attention paid to this specific dynamic with straight women until, except for some of the lesbian feminists, of course, and then until now again. Does that make sense?
Yeah. And I think that is a confusing argument at first. So I'll just unpack it just a little bit, which is that, the narrative about how difficult it is to be queer, is one that, some gay people themselves will also rehearse. And I think that gay men are more likely to share that narrative, to say, you know, well, of course I would be straight if I could, but, you know, I was born this way, so therefore you have to accept me. And, you know, that narrative presumes that it would be easier to be straight. And it's a narrative that doesn't really make sense when you take misogyny into account. If you think about all of the pain and suffering that women experience at the hands of men, it's hard to sustain that story about how it would be easier to be straight. But the story gets sustained because it's a story that does apply for the most part to gay white men, which is that they, you know, there is a pretty significant loss of privilege that comes with being a gay man. But for many lesbians, it's actually the opposite. There's often a sense of relief at having escaped all of those daily injustices that are part of the experience of being a woman in a relationship with a man. And so this is why I'm saying that I think we would be more attentive to the tragedy of heterosexuality if we had a more intersectional approach that actually accounted for patriarchy and misogyny in our conversations about sexual orientation in queer spaces. But, you know, again, because the conversation has been, I think, really dominated by men who've kind of set the agenda in their arguments about how, you know, sexuality is something we're born with, and how being queer is a loss of power and privilege. You know, it's been difficult for other accounts to get any airtime.
Totally. And it makes sense that people with the most privilege would be quickest to equate queerness with losing privilege, I guess. When you speak of that born this way dynamic, I'm curious what you think. I know you touch on it in the book, obviously, more eloquently than I'm trying to set you up for, but basically I'm curious about this idea of the born this way dynamic or rhetoric potentially limiting like female sexual agency or intentionality, that maybe it's not a bad thing if you weren't born this way, or maybe you're not sure one way or the other, but that you're able to choose queerness if you want to.
Totally. This is something I've written about quite a bit. And I think that's because I don't feel like I was born with a sexual orientation. In fact, when I think about that idea that I like emerged from my mother's body a lesbian, it's just it's kind of absurd when you think about it. I'm a social constructionist in this regard. I think that, you know, we have sexual desires and they are embodied, no doubt about it. And our attractions are very embodied. But that does not mean that they aren't formed through cultural experiences in the same way that, you know, you would have a totally different taste for a certain kind of food if you were born in another country. What you might find a delicacy there could be something you would find disgusting here. So we know that people's bodies, their tastes, the way their bodies move, even our health conditions, all of this we know are shaped by socioeconomic class, by the kind of labor that people do, by how people live their lives, all of that. And so, another excellent lesbian feminist scholar, Sarah Ahmed, who wrote Queer Phenomenology, which is one of my favorite books, you know, she talks about how we get oriented toward heterosexuality in such profound ways as children that it actually does, you know, it shapes our bodies, it shapes our brains. And if we're given other possibilities, then we can be shaped in other ways. And so I'm someone who felt a lot of attraction to boys and men as a younger person, had a long-term relationship with a man, and through college and into grad school. And it wasn't until in grad school, through basically engaging feminist studies, that I connected, like, I am most excited by, most sexually attracted to feminism. Like, that's my sexual orientation. Mm-hmm. And I want to like get with people who are down with feminism. And I really care maybe less about the bodies, and I care about those like liberatory values. And I also am really sexually attracted to like non-normativity and queered sex practices and thinking out of the box and all of that, and like not knowing what I'm going to get is very exciting. And so it wasn't like, I had a constant craving for lesbians. It wasn't anything like that. It was like
insatiable.
I want to, the way that we understand gender and sexuality now is so narrow. It's not enough for me. I want something bigger and wilder and fuller. And my experience was that it was much easier to find that kind of feminist and counter-normative person, you know, that I wanted to get with in the body of a woman than it was in the body of a man. I mean, I just did not encounter very many feminist men. And even the ones that I did encounter, I didn't really trust often, you know, like they revealing that they weren't all that feminist. So this is just all to say that I think if men were different, like if they were smarter, if they were more feminist, like if they were more empathic, if they were less self-interested, like would I be into them? Sure. So that's a really different thing than saying like, oh, maybe, you know, I was in the womb subjected to some kind of fetal androgen wash, or maybe I have like an enlarged hypothalamus, or maybe, or any of these other theories that people have come up with to explain homosexuality. You know, there's just such a strong attachment to the idea that we have like a gay body part that can be found somewhere, or that we had, you know, we were subjected to like an excess hormone.
Right. Like we have a bunch of testosterone or something.
Right. Yeah. That kind of thing. And, you know, I know a lot of people feel like that has a lot of explanatory power for them and just feels right to them. And I think at this point in my life, I'm not saying, well, I don't think that's true. What I'm saying is that's one story. And it's a story that's become so obligatory, so dominant, that it silences the rest of us who have a really different story about our sexuality.
Totally. I mean, honestly, reading your book gave me a lot of personal validation, I guess is the word, or it made me feel very held in a way that I didn't expect it to, just because of the way it acknowledged that, not necessarily path into queerness, but I don't know, the option of it and the agency and like the, I mean, personally, as a teenager, I had already that queer group of friends that you mentioned, like when you're teaching at Riverside, you know, the queer kids are going to be in the corner together or in the front row together a lot of the time. So I came of age in a very queer culture, and I probably at like 16 or 17 would identify as, you know, bisexual or creative, ways of saying pansexual, and then eventually getting that language. And I lived very only kind of queer sex and romance a lot of the time, but also with, you know, a lot of men in the mix too, but not really emotionally, more as, you know, bodies to objectify or to allow objectify me. But I guess I say all that to say I got into a relationship with a straight man like 4 years ago, and I still am, and I'm really happy. But sometimes there's been this part of me that has always known that one of the reasons that my straight-ish, you know, relationship feels really healthy or feels really fulfilling is that I'm not straight, if that makes sense. Like that I kind of treat, you know, I reorientated, like, after working for men's magazines and stuff, I really wanted to be able to treat men like they were women, and not that I believe in those gender binaries, but just basically treating everybody the same, which when you have these larger institutions of, you know, misogyny and patriarchy, it can be very hard to do. But, yeah, just reading the book felt like just a celebration of a lot of the aspects of queerness that make me feel like at home.
I really love that story. And I love hearing you say like that your queerness enables you to treat men like women, because, you know, I think for a lot of us, it's who are critical of the gender binary, you know, and see the damage that it causes. It's not, we're not saying let's get rid of gender or even let's get rid of gender binaries, you know, because there are multiple ones we could talk about and play with, but let's see these gender categories as, you know, they're moving targets, they're metaphors, they're like, you know, toys to be played with. And so, you know, that's part of what I'm hoping in that last chapter of the book to offer, which is to say, you know, there are a lot of great tools out there for reorienting a heterosexual relationship. Many of them come from queer feminists, and there's no reason they cannot be picked up by straight men. And, you know, one of them that I highlight there is this concept of woman identification. And so I really, you know, try to sell readers on the idea that something that would be really useful for straight men would be to be women identified. And the reason I go there is that it strikes me that one of the differences between lesbian feminist culture and straight culture is that in lesbian feminist culture, to be sexually attracted to women is kind of inseparable from the experience of wanting women's freedom. It's an investment in women as a whole. It's a respect for the inherent value of women's lives and women's ideas and women's leadership. And I think in many ways, straight men's desire for women is so much weaker. It's so much narrower. It's like, well, you know, I just find I'm attracted to women's bodies and I could never be attracted to men's bodies. And, you know, maybe it's I'm so in love with this woman and she's my best friend. Great. But rarely do men frame their heterosexuality in collective terms and in political terms, that to be oriented towards women, to feel such a strong desire for women, is a kind of investment in women, girls and women, and their futures. And so that is a pretty powerful difference, and it doesn't need to be that way. And, you know, when lesbian feminists wrote about being women identified, I think that was a big part of what they were articulating. I mean, they also, where they went with that was like that all straight women should be political lesbians. They should just, you know, force themselves to be with women. And that did not work out, clearly. So I'm not arguing for that. But what they were thinking about was that, you know, when women have sex with other women, there's something deeply affirming that happens, because in like objectifying, admiring, lusting after, you know, fucking another woman, you come face to face with how desirable your own body is, you know, with the value of your own sexuality. And because of the gender binary, that way of thinking about what sex can do for us has been really blocked for straight people, because the whole idea is that you're having sex with the other, with the opposite. But I want to suggest that I think straight men could have sex with women in a way that is animated by identification, rather than oppositeness. And so, and I call all of that deep heterosexuality. So that's my vision. It's imperfect, or it's in part, it's just a sliver maybe of.
Yeah. It's in progress.
Right.
I mean, I love your call for deep heterosexuality, because I think back to like writing for Melt magazine, which kind of gave me the opportunity to reach out and interview you a couple times in the past. So much of what I was after was just similarly aligned, just opening up, you know, these conversations and opening up these literal blockages in the culture and consciousness to like expand the experience of men in ways that actually bring them more pleasure and more healing and more embodiedness. Like this kind of feminist call for deep heterosexuality, of course, a lot of, you know, straight men could have some, you know, quick or enduring resistance to it, but a lot of men would find instant pleasure in it if they allowed themselves.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it's important to invite men in. I think a lot of straight men still feel like feminism is something that women do and they support, like allies. Right. And so, you know, it's really so amazing and vital and beautiful that we have such an infrastructure now in this country of white anti-racist organizations and white folks organizing for Black lives and white folks organizing to end white supremacy. And, you know, there are a small handful of those kinds of projects that men are engaged in thinking about how to divest from patriarchy. But it's just a fraction of what we see in terms of white anti-racist organizing. And so I do think we need to ask, like, what's going on with men that they're not mobilizing around their own gendered freedom, you know, becoming more fully human and how they relate to women. And so I'm hoping to see that in my lifetime.
Me too. And yeah, I want to say again how I think queer people will love this book. I know they already are. But like just the way that it touches on some of the unique aspects of queer friendship and family building and community. I find it really beautifully put together, and Margot and I were kind of laughing. Margot, our Tierney Talks producer and super person who's on the line with us, we were kind of laughing about, Margot, do you want to touch on your expectations of kind of hetero friends, like female friends, and kind of a dynamic that often occurs with that you see when they get a new relationship?
Well, so I'm queer and I'm in a queer relationship with a female, and I was just expressing to Tierney that I've just kind of accepted that when I have a friend, a female friend who's heterosexual or femme friend, I just have to accept the fact that when they are, I guess, going through the courtship of a heterosexual opposite sex relationship, that they're going to kind of check out to go nurture that. And maybe, like you guys were saying, or Tierney was saying, kind of swallow themselves for that time. And I just have to I have to just know that they're gonna, you know, come back and be a part of the friendship again.
Yeah, that sucks.
It does suck.
It sucks because it's, yeah. That's another good example of queer labor, because of course they, you know, when that dude dumps them down the road, you know, they're gonna call you up.
Right.
So, Yeah, I mean, there's just a lot of, as we know, really, really, really dysfunctional heterosexual rituals. And I think that kind of immersion is one of them. I was really interested that several people wrote to me, you know, we're in the middle of all these terrible wildfires all up the Western coast. And several people wrote to me saying they thought of this book when they read that one of the fires, the one down in Riverside County, was caused by a gender reveal party, because what we saw is such devastation, you know, acres and acres of wildlife lost and people needing to be evacuated and terrible health conditions. And it just was such a metaphor, because I do talk about gender reveal parties as one of the really weird hetero rituals that queer people find so troubling. Because part of what I'm trying to get at is that this idea that queer people are envying straight people is actually pretty ludicrous when you look at how repulsed we often are by things that straight people do, and how straight people do like bachelor and bachelorette parties, and how they, you know, all of their gendered rituals that involve them being separate from one another, and their obsession with like fetal genitals, like all of this from a queer perspective is just bizarre.
I want to read a little from just some random random things Jane writes in the book about this. Or first you include a quote from a queer Hispanic female who you interviewed, because there's a chapter called A Sick and Boring Life, quoting Edith Massey in the John Waters movie Female Trouble, which I love. I love every time the Edith refrain is brought up in the book. But and the Edith's quote is, "The world of heterosexuals is a sick and boring life." And this other person who I brought up says, "They all do the same thing as other single or coupled straight people, as if they're following a given agenda. It's uncomfortable how boring they are." And then, Jane, you go on to write that heterosexuality is intended to be boring. Its very design is aimed at control and predictability. But, I mean, of course, we see one of these boring rituals create extreme devastation, as you brought up, but it's also just very funny and refreshing to go through the compilation of queer people's comments about straight people in the book. It's worth getting the book for.
Yeah. I really enjoyed hearing from people about that. And, you know, I basically asked queer people what they thought about straight culture and boring, you know, kind of soul killing, predictable, uninspired, you know, those were really central themes for a lot of queer people.
I'll summarize it with this quote, and I know we're going to wrap up soon, but I thought this was just funny and very quick and perfect. "I like straight people just fine, but straight culture is dull as dirt. It isn't even culture. It's just what's left over when all the interesting stuff has been driven out." So a femme wasp said that, but I guess I just like highlighting the immense contributions of queer people to our culture at large. And, it's not surprising that we would turn to queer people to help out the heterosexual project and hopefully eventually make heterosexuality a story that isn't a tragedy, because there has been such a feminist uptick, not only among women, but among activated men.
Yes.
Jane, I want to quickly mention I know you have two other books you've written, but the other book I have of yours is Not Gay, Sex Between Straight White Men. And I just want to say, I think I've told you this before, but I read this book when you published it in 2015, and I've never had more people stop me in public to talk about what I was reading, especially because I was at a pool in Palm Springs and it was just getting everybody riled up. But I love this book. I want to recommend it to everybody listening, and I'll quickly describe how it very much coincides with, you know, the research shared in the new book, in that it like looks at a really normative or privileged section of society sociologically and reveals how weird it is. And in this case, it's the way that, you know, gender and race privilege allow white men a lot of sexual freedom or queerness without being kind of designated or identified as queer. And Jane goes through different hetero male institutions like the army and the Hell's Angels and fraternities, and kind of, how would you say, examines the queerness inherent in those, you know, social situations, but like also the way that they protect themselves so we don't actually hear that it's queer or something. Does that make sense?
Yes. Yeah. Hearing you summarize that book. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think I would probably not say, I don't think of those behaviors as queer. I think, because for me, I mean, they're certainly homosexual, and that's what, that's what the book is about, is that there's a tremendous amount of homosexual contact that's built into straight male environments. But if we think of queerness as a kind of embrace of gender and sexual non-normativity, and straightness as a fetish for the normal, then, you know, what I'm trying to zero in on in that book is that there are actually really straight ways to engage in homosexual sex, and straight men have perfected the art form.
Well, this has been so fun for me. There's other things, you know, jumping out that maybe we didn't get into, but obviously there's so much rich stuff in the book. You published it with NYU Press, and that's the best place to get it, online through NYU Press. It'll come quickly. Jane, is there anything that we didn't touch on you want to speak about, or anything going on you want to end on? Margo, I invite you all.
No, the only thing I would say is that you can find me on Twitter at The Queer Jane. And so I'm posting some of the coverage of the book there. And I also have a website, janewardphd.com, where you can find me and my work.
janewardphd.com. And then you said Twitter at The Queer Jane?
That's right.
Okay, cool. And I'm going to be raffling two copies of the newest book, The Tragedy of Heterosexuality. So if you're listening, please DM me on Instagram at tstar7. And please let me know that you want to be submitted for the raffle. I'm going to take everyone's names and then use the tool for it to automatically generate the winners, and I'll ship them to you. You're going to really enjoy the books. Margo, thank you for recording us and for being here with us.
No problem. Thank My you, pleasure.
Margo.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, I just remembered two quick things I want to also end on. One, just things I love about the book. I love thinking about the way that women might eroticize our own bodies, like outside of the gaze of heterosexuality, and how unfortunate it is that the modern beauty industry is so much rooted in the eugenicist, like, teachings of trying to get men and women to be more, like, beautiful to one another, but actually just less repulsive. Male repulsion and its effect on my own body or sense of my own physical body is very interesting to me. And then kind of relatedly, I love the idea of like a part of men, you know, part of deep sexuality is men learning to love so many aspects of, you know, being a woman, or at least the one example that I loved that I'm like belaboring to spit the hell out is that like among lesbians, feminist lesbians, having a vagina that could stretch or, you know, hold an immense amount is, or at least can be, very arousing and exciting and sexually, not necessarily beneficial, but likable, you know, a positive quality for an erotic experience. And it's just very interesting in contrast with the tight pussy politics of heterosexuality, and that the idea that it can take, you know, that can hold space is like a bad thing or a faux pas. So I will never forget that illustration. Thank you, Jane.
Oh, sure. Yeah, I love that. That's such a good example too of difference. I mean, the reason that's significant is because for lesbians, the focus is on the vagina itself and the pleasure it can experience. And in straight culture, the focus is on the penis's experience of the vagina.
Right. We need vagina centric and, more pleasure for everybody, please. More reading for everybody. Jane, I just am so grateful you came on. I would love to be your student. Your students are so lucky. Go UC Riverside.
They're amazing. I'm really lucky to have them.
I bet they keep on inspiring you too. Well, until next time, come back someday. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Tierney Talks. I'm Tierney Finster, and I'm sending you nothing but love from Los Angeles. Follow me on Instagram and Twitter at 2star7, and please subscribe to the podcast if you haven't already. Our show music is Let Me Love You by Dis Fantasy, featuring Margot Padilla and Brittany Love. Today's show was recorded and edited by Margot Padilla and hosted and produced by me. Until next time, XOXO.